Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Banking Matters. I'm your host, Daniel Baker. Joining us today for part two of two, we have Paul Cummings. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me back again. Appreciate it.
So, Paul, I know we just ended the last episode. We were talking about the seizure of the 4,000 pounds of cocaine that you did while you were working with the Treasury and everything. And you mentioned something in the break we had in between. I've got to ask you to share that with us because it was pretty funny.
Sure. Well, we were talking about what I failed to mention at the first part of that story was that when I got the phone call that airplane had departed out of Eagle Pass, I was actually on the golf course with my daughter. She was playing in a golf tournament, and I was walking the course with her. And I mean, I was in a pair of, I had a polo shirt on, jeans, my golf cleats, and I got that call, so I had to go racing out to the airport. And, you know, luckily I had my badge and gun on me, but that was it. And I mean, literally, because I didn't anticipate that would go to an enforcement action as quickly as it did. You know, it just goes to show that I should have been more prepared and in thinking that might have been where it was going to go. But I just didn't have any clue. But yeah, the picture that I have that I'll share with you. It looks like I just came off the golf course. So, the other two gentlemen that I'm with, they're dressed appropriately in the appropriate special agent attire. But yours truly was completely tactically unprepared to conduct that enforcement action. But it worked out fine.
That's fantastic. We'll have to see if we can get the image up on here to share with our viewers. That would be awesome.
That'd be great.
Well, Paul, this part of the second part of the special, I really wanted to kind of speak to you about your current position, because right now you're the director of risk management, and obviously you've got all this experience behind you, which is phenomenal and great. But I want to talk to you about the environment today. I mean, there's been a lot of back and forth about what's happening in the market. I mean, we've had several large financial institutions shut their doors. What are you seeing in the market today? Have you seen this before? Like, talk to me from your perspective. What's going on?
Well, obviously, my banking career is relatively limited. For the amount of time that I've had, but really, risk management is something that's innate in me. I mean, that's what I did as a cop. I mean, you have to analyze. You know, what you're getting ready to do and determine, okay, is it worth the risk to do whatever that enforcement action is or whatever you're going to do? And so I really think that you know, this question comes up a lot is that, you know, yeah, you were a cop for all these years, you know, how are you adjusting? You know, I'm still adjusting. You might in this next podcast, you might need to have that conversation with my CEO. He might answer better on Mr. Wilkinson, our CEO here at Keystone, might answer whether I'm adjusting all that well or not, but risk management is key. I've always felt like it's key that making a risk-based approach to decision making in the bank really is the way to go. And again, I'm very conservative, and I'm geared to say no, and that's different than other areas of the bank that are more geared to say yes or want to do something. But I think. You know, from my experience, it's good to have somebody in the bank who's willing to say no, who's willing to say, okay, guys, this can be a problem. If we go down this road, here's what you can expect as consequence to that. And I think it's so important that your chief risk officer, your compliance officer, BSA officer, internal audit department, whatever, any of those risk management, information security officer, any of those risk management positions, I think it's so important that they have the full authority by the CEO and by the board to be able, without any retaliation or without any issue, that they can raise their hand and feel comfortable raising their hand, saying, "Okay, guys, this could be a problem." And so I think that's key to this position. And again, I think for me, it's a lot easier because of who I am, but I really try to encourage that with the other departments of the bank too, that, you know, if you see something, say something. I mean, that's the Department of Homeland Security says that all the time. I think that's also key with our employees from a risk management perspective. Now, you mentioned just a second ago that we've had some bank failures that that have happened back in March, April of this last year. One of the things that I did personally was I got onto the Federal Reserve's website and downloaded their examinations. It's not very often you get to read another bank's examinations, especially banks that are in a troubled condition. And so I downloaded those examinations, both for Signature Bank. I'm trying to think of the Silicon Valley Bank, and downloaded them and really started to go through them. And you start to see a pattern in those that the risk management practices were either non-existent or if they were there, had no authority whatsoever. I mean, SVB Bank, they didn't have a risk officer for a year and a half, maybe 2 years. And that's a huge bank. I mean, multi-billion dollar bank, and they don't have a chief risk officer. They had a compliance committee, maybe. It met like once a quarter. I mean, and here these guys are lending and operating in a very high risk environment. You know, when you're dealing with venture capitalists, you're dealing with a lot of technology driven companies. I mean, that's high risk in my opinion. That's a high risk area. And they had no framework around any of that. Not saying you can't dip your foot in that and deal with that. But it's just like when I talk to our president, CEO, and guys here at Keystone, you know, I will never say you can't do something. I just need to know what it is you want to do so that we can devise the appropriate risk assessment. So
make the informed decision.
And so that way, and the examiners, again, this is what they tell me, that they won't tell a bank, not to do something either.
Right.
But as long as you have the appropriate risk mitigants out there, everybody's fully informed on that board on what that is, then I think you're okay to go. You know, there's been times here where I've said, no, I don't want to do that. And they've said, we appreciate your opinion, but we're going to do it. So now it's up to you to figure out what we need to do to mitigate that. And so I've said, you know what, I don't like it, but that's my job. And so that's what we've done here. And so I think having that risk-based approach, I think when it comes to these decisions, I think is the way to go. And the examiners are really all into this. I mean, this is where examinations now for the last year and a half have really focused on are the risk management practices in the bank. And it's not just in what we would consider the traditional risk areas, you know, internal audit, compliance, BSA, or I was going to say AML, I guess it's AML CFT now,
right.
And you know, information security officer. I mean, those are kind of the traditional risk areas of the bank that kind of control that. But I'm spending some more of my time on the credit side of the bank. I'm spending more of my time on the liquidity side of the bank. I'm spending more of my time kind of looking at the overall picture. The examiners now have made it pretty clear to me that risk management encompasses everything at the bank, and that the board should have a good understanding that if you do something in one area of the bank, what is the impact going to be in the other areas of the bank?
I'm gonna jump in really quick if that's all right, Paul. Yeah, you mentioned a couple different things that I wanted to kind of touch base, and one of them was that sometimes you just get overridden and that you need to have a safe and good environment to be able to raise those objections, to raise those concerns. So then it's a twofold question. The first one is, so who then gets the final say? Who makes the final call? Is it the board? Is it the CEO? Who makes the final decision there? And then how do you create an environment where it is okay for you to raise your hand and say, hey, like, this is not a good idea, we shouldn't be doing that? Like, how do you get those two elements?
Well, I'll answer the second part first. And again, I can only talk about my experiences here.
Right.
It really starts from the top. You really have to have your chairman of the board, your CEO, your board to be fully on board with that. I mean, they are all about making sure that we do things right, that we're committed to doing things right, and we're not going to tolerate anybody in this bank that tries to take a shortcut, get around regulation, whatever you want to call it. So really the tone has to be set from the top. And I think this bank does an outstanding job here. And that's in culture throughout the bank.
Yeah.
It has to start from the top, from the board level on down, and flow completely through the bank. And again, I think this bank does an outstanding job of that. You have to, obviously you're an employee. I get it. And ultimately the board has the ultimate responsibility, decision-making responsibility, along with the chairman and the CEO and bank president. But again, if they're on board with doing things right, if they're on board with following regulations, if they've looked at you and said, Paul, if something's really not right, we need to know about it. We'll stop it until we can make it right. That's what I need to hear. I recognize I'm paid to be very conservative.
You're paid to say no.
I am paid to say no. I get that. And if it was my way, I'd say no on everything. You know, you don't make any money that way. I get that too.
True.
So there has to be a balance between that. There has to be a balance of us. Yes, we're willing to accept this amount of risk. But what can we do to put into place to mitigate as much of that risk as we can? And that's where it becomes important, really communication, really using the audit committee, using the compliance committee, you know, using those chairmen of those committees to really educate them, using them as allies, as people to really educate and get them to understand the risks. And so they can articulate that appropriately at those board meetings and other committee meetings.
I'm assuming then that you have like policies and procedures in place about like what risks are just inherently acceptable. Like these risks are great. These are acceptable. So then the question I have is when you get one that doesn't fall in the typical, when you have the atypical transaction, what's the process for that transaction? Because I know some institutions, their policy is if it's an atypical transaction, it doesn't fall in the scope, we don't even touch it. What's your perspective on it?
That's typically how we do it here. If we have transactional activity that all of a sudden comes up that's not within those guidelines, we're not going to do it until we have a full understanding of either. I mean, maybe we need to change our policies and procedures.
Right.
I mean, that's always something. I mean, just like with the lending policy, you know, one of the things we do, I look at the loans and say, okay, you know, how many exceptions to the loan policy do we have? And I evaluate those. And so then I have to make the determination, okay, are those one-offs that are true exceptions,
or is there a pattern here?
Is there a pattern here? Yeah. And so I need to take a closer look at our policy, and maybe we just need to make some changes to our policy to account for that. If they're good, and so yes, I think that's the answer to your question. I think that's the answer to any bank that you know if it's outside of your policies and procedures and it's atypical of what you normally do, then you probably don't need to do it until you have a good understanding of what it is and how it is going to affect. And again, everything that goes through my mind is what are the regulators going to say when they see it? What, because they're going to look at me and they're going to say, okay, you know, we can't control these bankers around in here, but you know better. And I've had that conversation before and I don't like it. It's not pleasant. And so I think it's incumbent to really, when you get to that, to have those conversations and really understand what that transaction is. But prior to me getting on this call with you, this podcast with you, the CFO and I were talking about some GL entries and some things, some accrued interest and some things like that. And that's one of the things we're kind of working through because it's a non-standard. It's not something that normally happens. And so we're talking about, okay, how are we going to memorialize this? How are we going to write this up in our memo? And kind of what are we going to do? And how is this going to fit within our risk assessment? But we're going to do all that prior to anybody signing tickets and doing that transaction.
So then what does that look like? What does a change in policy look like? I mean, because there are instances, right? Something comes up and maybe a pass on the first one, but 2, 3, 4 keep cropping up and you start seeing in the industry and you're like, you know what? Maybe this is something we want to get involved in. Maybe this is something we want to start doing. How does that policy change look like at Keystone? What are you doing?
Well, what we do, What we do here, you know, when we get ready to do those kind of things, obviously the stakeholder, the business entity that's responsible for that, you know, it's their responsibility to kind of prove it. Right. That's probably not the right way to say it, but that's
that makes sense.
But they've got to kind of prove and say, okay, here's why we want to change this, mm-hmm. and maybe it's a regulatory change, maybe something's changed from a regulatory standpoint, or maybe, you know, I'm kind of a nerd. I read a lot of the commentary that comes out from the Federal Reserve and the FDIC, because, you know, reading that tells me where the regulations are going, and so I can kind of get ahead of the game by reading some of that commentary, some of these things that some of these FIL letters and stuff that come out, because I can kind of see where we're going, and so then I can start saying, okay, maybe we do need to start thinking about making a change here. Maybe we do need to crack down on this part of our portfolio or whatever. I mean, crypto is a prime example. You know, there was a lot of noise, you know, late last year, you know, year before last, about banks getting involved in crypto. What's that going to look like? You know, how's that going to be regulated and this and that? And, you know, that's one of the things that I look at all the time, because, you know, located here in Austin, we're in a community here where that is not unknown for people to use cryptocurrency to conduct transactions.
Yeah.
And so we have to have in policy, how are we going to deal with that? And are we going to deal with that? And, you know, how are we going to be looked at when the regulators come? That's the question I always mm-hmm. ask. Well, here's what the regulators
going to
say.
The rest of you listening, thank you for tuning in.
I use that all the time. These guys are probably tired of hearing that, because I say that all the time. You know, the regulators aren't going to like that or whatever. But there's things like that come up. But it becomes incumbent upon us to really prove what it is we want to do, changing in those policies, and really have that supporting documentation to be able to present that to the board or to that committee and then to the board and mm-hmm. say, this is the change that we want to have made, and here's why, and here's if we're increasing risk in an area, here's the mitigants that we've put around that for whatever we're doing. You know, one of the things here we've done at Keystone that I'm really proud of is that we have really gotten into online banking, where a customer can come online and within 3 or 4 minutes can open a bank account here at Keystone, and it's AI driven. I mean, we have a decision making tree that really is kind of, it goes out and looks at, I don't know, 100 or 200 different sources out on the web, and, you know, runs driver. I mean, does all that work that a relationship specialist might take 40 minutes to do, it can do in about 3 minutes. But it's also raises some risks, because now you're passing more private information through an IT channel. How do you know who that person is on the other end of that computer? You know, there's a lot of things that before we made those changes that we had to go through to really understand what the risks were associated with that. And we had to document all that. I ran it by different regulatory agencies, let them look at it, got their feedback. Yeah. It's an ongoing process. And I think that's what needs to be done. I'm really of the mindset, and again, I'm in the minority here, but I really have tried to use our regulatory agencies as consultants as best I can. You know,
well, I mean, really, it's also a different perspective for you, because I mean, you come from like the government background and everything like that. So, you know, they're just people, right? Their goal is to not necessarily to do the gotcha. You may find one or two, but most of the time it's not to do the gotcha, but to really work with the banks and everything.
That is absolutely correct. And my dad told me the best way of managing and working with the regulators is to remember two words: no surprises. Make sure that they are fully on board with what you're doing. Talk to them on a regular basis, and have that back and forth with them. And so I've really tried to encourage any place that I've worked, but especially here, that we really have tried to have a real good working relationship with both the Texas Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending and with the FDIC to really have that partnership with them and really try to get them to help us. So when they do show up to do an examination, they know exactly what we're doing, and they've looked at things, and they we're in that constant communication. And I really bothers me that a lot of banks don't take advantage of that. I mean, those regulators, they would much rather have you pick up the phone and call them and ask them a question or get some help on something, versus you not doing that, and then they show up at your bank and you, something's messed up.
Yeah, they have to dig it up later.
And then you got to deal with it.
I'm assuming that's primarily, like, you're the primary individual that reaches out to the regulators and whatnot, that you're that principal point of contact with them.
I do. Yes, sir. That's correct. That's correct.
Would you say it's important for, like, every bank to kind of have that person, like, that principal point of contact with the regulators?
Absolutely. I wrote an article. Maybe I need to send it to the TBA. Maybe y'all would publish it. but I've got one that I've worked on, but it's called, the title of it's called Learning the Love Language of Your Regulators. Really, it's about understanding how to communicate effectively with your regulatory agency.
That's great.
I think there is an art to that, and really understanding what they want to hear, understanding what you need to hear, and understanding what that process is. And I think that's so important. It should not be an adversarial relationship. And mm-hmm. when I go to banks, and especially when I was doing some auditing, and I would see that, I hated that, because it is not fun for anybody. And right. and the regulators are smart people, and they have good ideas, and they're just waiting for banks to pick up that phone or send an email. And we have a compliance question here. Typically, once it gets to my level, the first thing out of my mouth is, has anybody thought to call the FDIC or FinCEN or the state and ask
them? Find out what they think.
You know, I mean, the lawyers have given us this answer, and yes, this audit firm's given us this answer, and that's great and fine. But has anybody thought about calling the folks that don't cost us anything, number one, and finding out what's their opinion? I mean, they're the ones that are going to be grading us. Right. So didn't it make more sense to ask them?
Like asking the teacher at school.
That's exactly right. And I hate the fact that there's a lot of banks that don't take advantage of that. And I really think that's unfortunate.
So I had to laugh a little bit to myself, because when you're talking about the love languages, my wife and I have obviously had conversations about, like, what's your love language and how can I make you happy and everything like that. And probably the first one that went through my head is maybe the love language of purchasing gifts might not be the best idea with your regulators.
Probably not. Yeah, that one's probably not going to need to be in
probably
there.
Probably wouldn't cross that threshold.
And that's funny. I mean, that's why I started writing that article, because my wife and I had been teaching a class at church on love languages. And that was what, and I thought, man, you know, it's almost like a marriage that you have with these regulators.
It's a relationship, that's for sure.
You got to learn how to commit. But that is something that I think banks really miss out on. And it causes, you know, I've seen banks get off the rails with regulators, and it really, the bank wasn't doing anything wrong, but the way that they communicated it was not good. And they got off into areas that had no reason to do, had they communicated that effectively and clearly to begin with. And I've seen it on both sides. I think the regulators could learn a little bit more about how to communicate with banks better. But I definitely think the banks have a lot of room to
responsibility there.
Absolutely. That's right.
Well, Paul, we unfortunately we're almost out of time on our second episode as well. But I really did want to give you the opportunity. I asked all my guests this: if you could give one piece of advice to banks today. I know we've talked about training, we've talked about relationship with your regulators, we've talked about a lot of different things. But from your experience, if you could give one piece of advice to banks today, what piece of advice would you give?
Well, I think based on my prior experiences at other banks, seeing both good and bad, I think culture is so important in the bank. And treating your employees with respect and compensating them appropriately and really doing what needs to be done to take care of your employees. I know you're probably tired of me saying this, but I'm going to say it again, because I quote my dad a lot. Because I mean, he was president and CEO of a bank
for many years.
And so I, you know, a lot of times when I'm talking to people, it's like, I've heard that before. Where have I heard that before? Oh yeah, my dad. But my dad, Jim Cummings, he told me this very early in my career. He said, if you want to be successful in as a CEO of a bank, he said, first thing you do is you take care of your employees. He said, hire the best that you have, that you can. Pay them and compensate them as best that you can. Make the work environment as best that you can. Resources, give them all the resources that they need. He said, if you'll do that, the next tier, customer service, that's not a problem.
It'll take care of itself.
That he said, because if you take care of your employees, they will take care of your customers. And if mm-hmm. you take care of your customers, your bank will grow and you will have a lot of profits. He said it runs in that direction. And he said, but the key is having a good work environment and really taking care of your employees, regardless of what that is, whether that's compensation, right. whether that's in training, resources, regardless of whatever it is, but to hire the best that you can and have a great culture for those people to want to come to work. And because if they want to come to work, they'll do the right thing. Mm-hmm. They won't click on those things they're not supposed to click on, hopefully. they'll do the right thing. And not only will they do the right thing for the bank, they'll do the right thing for the customer. And that's yeah. important too. And so I think good. That's a great, that's good. That's not Paul Cummings' advice. I give credit to Jim Cummings on that. I think that is the best piece of advice that I got. And it's one that I try to live every day here at the bank. And luckily, this bank here really thrives on culture. And our CEO and bank president really pushed that. And I think that's important. And I think having been at a bank where that wasn't that way, it is a huge difference. It is night and day between those organizations. And so culture, I think, would be my advice, is to really CEOs, bank presidents, senior management, anybody.
That's how it works down.
You got to focus on the culture. Make sure you've got the best work environment that you can have.
I like that, Paul. Thank you very much.
All right. I'll don't thank me. Thank my dad. I'll tell him that I quoted him again. So
that would be awesome. Well, Paul, unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you very much for joining us for this special.
You bet. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
For the rest of you listening in, thank you for tuning in, and that's Banking Matters.